The media landscape in America is busted. Americans are on to the omissions, the half-truths, and the outright lies being propagated against we, the people. Your host, Tom Harris, will bring you the other side of the story.
Weeks ago, we interviewed two rural residents, Christine Burke from Ontario and Chaz Thomas from Illinois, who had the misfortune of having massive industrial wind turbines erected close to and around their homes, actually quite close in Christine's case. Shortly after the turbine construction began, the drinking water aquifers that supplied the wells they had been pristine for decades became polluted and unfit for household use. Now, of course, Christine has to bring in gallon jugs from the town. So it's an incredible nuisance and also a health hazard as well, because they still do use the water for washing. Today, we're going to find out why this occurred from a Wallaceburg, Ontario-based geologist, Dr. Keith Benn, who's been working hard to help people who lost access to their water wells when industrial wind turbine facilities, I won't call them wind farms, were constructed. Dr. Keith Benn is a professional geologist who holds a BSc from Western University, an MSc from Laval University, and a PhD in structural geology from Montpellier University in France. He also did postdoctoral studies in the structure and tectonics of Precambrian greenstone belts, and we're going to identify what those are during our program. Keith worked for 17 years, close to where I live, actually, here in Ottawa, as a professor at the University of Ottawa, and then he decided to pursue his real love, working in the minerals industry, which he does to this day. In recent years, Keith has filled roles as Director of Structural Geology for Goldcorp Inc., Vice President of Exploration for two junior exploration companies, and he currently works internationally as an independent consultant. And here's the exciting new development. Dr. Keith Benn will represent the new Blue Party of Ontario in the upcoming Lambton-Kent, Middlesex, Ontario by-election. So first of all, let's define what these Precambrian greenstone belts are that you did postdoctoral studies on.
Well, greenstone belts are geological regions that are made up of volcanic rocks and sedimentary rocks that form in certain plate tectonic type environments. And Precambrian greenstone belts are those greenstone belts that were formed in the Precambrian age, most of them prior to 1.8 billion years ago. And all of the ones I've worked on were formed around 1.8 billion or 2.7 billion or about 3 billion years old. And there's a lot of that in northern Canada, in the Canadian Shield, which is mostly Precambrian rocks, and all Precambrian rocks, in fact. And one of the reasons those types of belts and in that time period are so very interesting to geologists, one of the reasons, is that they tend to be very rich in mineral deposits. In northern Ontario and northern Quebec, for instance, in the southeastern part of the Canadian Shield, you have a lot of gold mining that goes on in Timmins, Kirkland Lake, Rouyn-Noranda, Val d'Or. You can get from the name Val d'Or, you can determine that it's a gold rich region, the Valley of Gold.
Yeah.
And as well as other types of base metal deposits as well. So I did work, my postdoctoral studies were on a region in northern Quebec, but I was doing it in collaboration between the University of Quebec at Chicoutimi and the University of Toulouse, where I was based in France.
I understand they're called greenstone belts, partly because they're green.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. And one of the reasons they're green is because they have generally been metamorphosed, as we say, to a facies called greenschist. What that means, metamorphism is what happens to rocks when they get buried and deformed and tectonized, heated up. And then when they get brought to the surface again, they tend to preserve the mineralogy that forms during that metamorphism. Minerals that are typical of that metamorphic environment, you know, at 8 to 12 kilometers depth and around 400 or 500 degrees Celsius. So they and the name greenschist comes from the fact that one of the minerals, one of the common minerals in those rocks is chlorite. And chlorite tends to be green, so the rocks themselves tend to be green as well. Yeah. Not always, but many of the volcanic rocks are quite green, yeah.
I love talking to geologists because they have a reflection of what really happened in world's history. You see so often in the climate scare, for example, that you have lots of meteorologists and computer scientists and others. But I'm finding, generally speaking, that geologists are the ones we should be talking to because they know what happened in the real world. In some cases, we've been talking back in recent shows, we've been talking about the Phanerozoic, the last 600 million years, but you're talking way before that.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of what would be relevant to the evolution of today's climate would be in the Phanerozoic, because that's when Earth developed the oxygen-rich type of atmosphere that it has now, or more similar to what it has now, as opposed to the atmosphere that existed billions of years ago. You're right, I think, in that. Geoscientists, which include geochemists and people who use geochemistry of rocks, for instance, and isotopic studies of rocks to determine what the average temperature on Earth's surface and the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere might have been 400 million years ago, we tend to have a very long-term perspective, as you pointed out. Geological time is something that's almost beyond well, it is beyond the ken of most people. We don't think in terms of hundreds of millions of years generally. We tend to think in terms of a generation or two or three generations, and the First World War seems like eons ago, and in fact, it's yesterday, basically. Because geoscientists do tend to study things that occurred at some distant time in the past. From tens of thousands of years ago, right up to billions of years ago. We also have that idea of what in Earth history, in the context of Earth's very long history, there are things going on today that are not at all abnormal. People think if the temperature goes up, if in fact the temperature is going up a few degrees over the course of 100 or 200 years or something, that it's a catastrophe, when in fact it's one of the most normal things that happens on Earth. We have ice ages, and then we have warm periods, and we've been doing that for hundreds of millions of years and longer. When you look at things in that context, it does tend to buffer a little bit, your worry or your excitement about the so-called climate crisis, or what I call, and what so many people call, the climate scam. Because it really is. It's turned into a scam. It's a moneymaker.
Oh,
And
yeah.
politicians love it too, because it gives them a lot of power. Nothing that some types of politicians, there's nothing they love more than to have a big cudgel to beat people over the head with and make them afraid. So that they will obey whatever rules and regulations come along, like taxes on taxes on taxes and things like that. So, you're right about that.
It's interesting. The thing that moved me from a climate alarmist to what I like to call a climate realist was, in fact, the local geologist who brought me into his lab, and he showed me how, throughout the Phanerozoic, CO2 has been up to 10 times or even more today's levels, and CO or temperature was at sometimes very low. Like the one that really struck in my mind was 440 million years ago during an ice house period, when it was about 10 times as much CO2, and the temperature was the coldest in the last half billion years. And when I go to environment club meetings and bring that up, they just about have a fit. So, I mean, that's pretty
I
good
think you might be.
evidence that the climate changes and we're not
No,
seeing
but it's
anything
in.
unusual right now.
No, and this is in the geological record. I think you might have been thinking or speaking about the Silurian or the late Ordovician when you were talking about this massive ice age. And yes, the CO2 level is thought to have been roughly 10 times what it is now. And another thing that I point out, I'm actually looking at a graph in my PowerPoint presentation right now. This is, I'm not too sure how many people come out to political rallies and see people talking about the CO2 in the atmosphere over the last 600 million years. But anyway, I point out to them the fact that currently, you know, it seems that the average CO2 level in the atmosphere is around 180 parts per million. And there are scientists out there who tell us if it gets down to 150 parts per million, we're in big trouble, because that's called mass extinction territory. Because right. CO2 is, yes, plant food. And if the concentration gets too low, plants don't like that and they start to die off. And that could be really bad news for all the living organisms that eat plants or that eat animals that eat plants. It is a scam, but it's being used, as I said, as and a lot of people have become aware of this now, that it's being used as a way to gain control over us and try and force us to obey rules and regulations that normally people would not obey. And there's a big backlash against it now. I think you probably noticed it as well.
Fortunately.
Interestingly enough, you can barely pick up a newspaper even in the legacy media, as I call it, or the mainstream media, as some people call it. You can barely pick up a newspaper these days and not see, you know, articles about how, hey, wait a minute, it turns out that maybe CO2 isn't the culprit, you know.
Yeah, well, especially Ross McKittrick, he's writing in the National Post all the time, you know, and he's been a big help. Now, one of the outcomes of the climate scare, and there's lots of bad outcomes, but one of them is the belief that we can somehow stop climate change, building lots of industrial wind turbines and turning off our natural gas. But, you know, there's some side effects of these wind turbines, lots of them. And one of them was exposed to us from Christine Burke, who I introduced in the intro to the show. She believes that her drinking water aquifer has been ruined by the construction and operation of turbines near her home. Do you think she's right?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that people's water wells, which tap into the local aquifer, have been interfered with in a pretty serious way. It's variable from one residence to another, which is perfectly normal. We're talking about a natural system, and natural systems are kind of complex and they change from one place to another. But yes, in her case, and in the case of quite a few households in the northern part of the municipality of Chatham-Kent, where three industrial wind turbine complexes were constructed over the course of a decade or so. It seems that the industrial wind turbines did interfere with their wells. I mean, as Christine probably elaborated for you and your audience, they have a water well in their household on their property that they've been using for decades. I believe they're the third generation to use it, if I'm not mistaken. And I've talked to other people in the area as well, who are like fourth generation. You know, they've been using the same water well for 80 years. And industrial wind turbines are built in proximity within a few hundreds of meters. And suddenly they can't use the water from their wells anymore, because in some cases, their domestic water systems clog up with so much sediment that they can't even run water out of their taps, even if they wanted to.
Oh, wow.
And this all happened right at the time that the turbines were being constructed, and then during their subsequent operation.
Mm-hmm.
First, there are a number of reasons to believe that it is the wind turbines that interfered with the wells. And we can come back to that in a minute. Now, how that would happen, my only explanation that I can offer, and I don't think that it's not unique to me. I mean, I've read some papers published in the peer-reviewed literature where people have proposed how such a thing might happen, and not necessarily associated with wind turbines, but you know, it could be a microseismic earthquake, or it could be something else causing this kind of problem. Is that the mechanism would be that probably long wavelength, low frequency vibrations coming from the operation of these wind turbines disturbs the aquifer. And now it kind of depends to some degree on the type of aquifer you have. In this area, The aquifer is not real thick. It's on the order of a little under a meter to maybe 3 meters thick, depending on where you drill into it. And it's composed, to my knowledge, of glacial till, so fine-grained sediment deposited during the retreat of the glaciers. Well, possibly some during the advance of the glaciers and some during the retreat of the glaciers, on the order of approximately 10,000 years ago, during the last glaciation. And because during that glaciation, of course, in this area, we had about 1,000 meters of ice on the ground. And when those glaciers retreated, they deposited the sediment directly on top of the bedrock, which is the black shale, the famous black shale. Now, I think the aquifer, it seems as if it was common knowledge that the aquifer itself, which is composed of fine-grained sediments that has different minerals in it, like quartz and feldspar and micas and other minerals, in that fine-grained sediment, there were probably, and it only stands to reason, that there's probably a component of the aquifer that is made up of that black shale. I mean, as the glaciers move across the bedrock, they're going to tear up bits of that bedrock, grind it up by the pressure of the glacier sliding over it. And then when the glacier retreats, it's going to deposit that fine-grained black shale along with other minerals on the bedrock again. And all of the, in the course of history, when the glaciers retreat, and then for a while after that, there are big lakes over the area, so you have more sediment deposited on top, and then finally a layer of soil. So you have this 1 to 3 meter thick, we'll say, glacial till aquifer that's saturated with water, with other sediments on top of it, and then soil. And that aquifer is only about, on average, about 12 to 15 meters deep. It's not very deep. And there are other places in this general area here where it's only 4 or 5 meters deep.
Mm-hmm.
So if you place one of these gigantic wind turbine complexes on top of that, and then you let this thing operate, with the big blades spinning around being driven by the wind, how could the thing not transmit long wavelength vibrations into the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, as Christine might have mentioned to you, when they built these wind turbines, because they understood that the ground was not going to be sufficiently strong, we'll say, to support these giant wind turbines and to keep them from toppling over, they had to drive tens of steel pilings for each one of them through the soil, the sediment, the aquifer, and into the black shale bedrock underneath to stabilize these things, to hold them upright, to anchor them into the bedrock. So then any vibrations coming from the wind turbines are going to be transmitted down those pilings into the bedrock too, which is probably going to be transmitting the vibrations into the overlying aquifer. So basically it's a vibrational thing in my opinion. Now, it's possible too that when they drove these pilings in, that would have almost certainly broken up the black shale a bit more in the bedrock, and some of that's probably what we're seeing coming out of the water wells too. But I think much of it was already in the aquifer. But the thing was that just because of the way the nature of the aquifer, those tiny black shale fragments that were in there and have been in there for 10,000 years or whatever, they weren't mobilized in the water when people turn on their taps and their pumps are running and stuff and they're taking water from the aquifer. The black shale wasn't coming along with the water. But I think what's happened now, this is my interpretation, I think what's happened now is that because of these vibrations, it causes these very fine particles of black shale to be mobilized and into suspension in the groundwater. And then they flow along with the groundwater and it comes out of people's domestic water systems. So I think that's probably in general terms what's caused this to happen. There are several reasons to believe that the wind turbines are the culprits, that if you wish I could go into right now.
It's very, very important.
Well, the first thing is that these problems with people's drinking water supply just happened to occur as the wind turbines were constructed and then began to operate. I mean, there's that coincidence, okay? On top of that, as part of an all-hazard investigation that I participated in as an advisor, and we can come back to that later when you want to ask, if you want to ask any more questions about that. But one of the results from that is that we were able to compare analyses of water from 57 water wells located within a wind turbine complex to compare the results for water quality, turbidity, you know, cloudiness and the sediment in suspension and all that, with results that were obtained in a baseline study that was done in the same area prior to construction of the wind turbines.
Mm.
And it turns out that the amount of suspended solid in the water, on statistically speaking now, is 51% higher than it was prior to construction of the wind turbines. And the turbidity is 35% higher. So, and that suspended solid and turbidity is all related to that fine-grained, for the most part, black shale that's in suspension in the water. So right there, it tells you that you have a time comparison, a before and after comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Before wind turbines and after wind turbines. After wind turbines, a whole lot more turbidity and a whole lot more, statistically, and a whole lot more sediment in suspension in the water. Then we were able to compare the results from inside the wind turbine complex with the results from 9 wells that were sampled on the same aquifer, but outside of the wind turbine complex. So there you have a side-by-side comparison, spatial comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take the water quality from inside the wind turbine complex compared to the water quality from outside the wind turbine complex, it turns out that there's 160% more suspended sediment in the water inside the wind turbine complex.
Wow.
And 300% higher turbidity.
Mm.
These are statistics, you know, and if you had a bigger sample population, numbers might change a bit. But still, I think it tells the story that if you look at this evidence, the only plausible explanation that you can derive from it is that the wind turbines were constructed and people's water wells were impacted, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think at that stage, it's no longer up to the owners of the wells to prove that the wind turbines caused this damage. It would be up to whoever was responsible for the wind turbines to prove that they didn't do it.
Yeah, exactly. And how's the government? Yeah. How's the government responded? Did they take that conclusion, or do they try to push it aside?
Well, for now, it's been pretty much swept under the rug. The all-hazard investigation I mentioned was organized and managed by the Ministry of Health in the province of Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, that all-hazard investigation was not properly completed. And by which I mean that in the scope of working, the original scope of work, it was intended that both the water and the sediment in suspension in the water be collected and sampled and then analyzed separately.
Mm-hmm.
And that only makes sense because the reason for the all-hazard investigation was because people were complaining very loudly that suddenly they had all this sediment in their water. So you wouldn't just analyze the water, you would analyze the sediment too.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since we knew there could be black shale in there. And it turns out that in the end, they collected water from 57 wells, but they didn't collect sediment from a single one.
Huh. Well, that's a nice way to test. You just don't see the problem.
Yeah. Well, in theory, they tried. I mean, they hired a contractor to do the work fine. And I think what happened was that the contractor used the standard sampling techniques that one uses in a normal water well investigation, which is different from what this study was all about. So it never occurred to them that they were going to have to capture particles on the order of 5 microns in size. So the filters that the contractor was using were these standard filters that couldn't capture anything that small. So they just didn't sample it.
Mm.
And when the Ministry of Health was informed that there was no sediment being captured, they just said, oh, we can't do it. We can't sample the sediment, so we won't worry about that.
Mm.
And The advisory committee, or the expert panel, as it was called, that I participated in, by the time we were informed of this, it was too late. The sampling was pretty much done. So we could go into more detail on that, but for now, that should probably suffice. So then subsequently, in our report, and when I say our, it's the expert panel that was responsible for writing the final report on this study. We were the scientific advisory committee, if you will. And we stated very clearly in the recommendations at the end of the report that we wrote, that I'm actually looking at it right here. I won't read the whole thing, but there were three bullet points, basically, where we said an effort needs to be made to sample these solid particles, the sediment, and to analyze them using, you know, standard ICP-MS techniques to analyze them for the metals that we were afraid were in these sediments. That's the thing about black shales. They tend to be very rich in heavy metals. Uh-huh. And then we also said, you know, that if it turns out that these sediments do contain heavy metals, then it would be important to do studies on bioaccessibility and bioavailability, which would give information on whether that metal in the sediment, if ingested, would then be released within the digestive tract from the sediment and maybe enter into your bloodstream and into tissues and into your organs. Because, you know, if you have lead and mercury and arsenic getting into your body, that's not a real good thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, the about a year after we submitted the final report, which was the end of 2021, there had been no signal given by the Ministry of Health to anyone that they intended to go ahead with this work.
Huh. So they put an expert panel together and they didn't follow your recommendation. Jeez.
Well, no. Yeah, well, they followed some recommendations during the study. We provided input on some things, like, you know, we helped to identify the preferred contractor based on submissions, and we did some other things like that. And, you know, it wasn't like we were completely ignored. But the ministry, I think probably it has just more to do with the fact that the people in the ministry managing the project were not familiar, really, you know, they weren't scientists, they weren't really familiar with what needed to be done. And so when they were told that our filters don't capture any sediment, they just said, oh, well, there's no sediment to be captured. Now, and then the recommendations that we put in our report, no, they didn't follow up on that. So what happened was, more recently, in late 2022, several well owners, 9 well owners, got together and pitched in some money. And then Christine Burke, who you spoke to, and some other very helpful people in the Wallaceburg area, with a group called Wallaceburg Area Wind Concerns, did a crowdfunding campaign and raised some more money. And we sampled 9 wells, some of which were part of the study and some weren't, the investigation rather. And we sent them off to a lab where we knew they could filter the sediment out and do a proper analysis. So they did. And when it came back, lo and behold, every one of the samples of sediment here, I'm going to pull up my image to remind myself here in my PowerPoint presentation, every one of the 9 wells had some heavy metals in the sediment. And most of them had multiple heavy metals. 8 out of 9 have appreciable concentrations of arsenic. All 9 have fairly appreciable concentrations of lead. A couple have mercury in the sediments. And then most of them also have barium and molybdenum and nickel and cobalt and chromium and cadmium as well. So now you asked me, where is the government with this now? Well, there are 2 levels of government concerned. We took this new information to the municipality of Chatham-Kent. And Rhonda Jubenville, one of the municipal councillors for that specific area where this problem is acute, put a motion forward to the municipal council saying, look, we need to follow up with the Ministry of Health and urge them to start doing something. And we did deputations, several of us, for the municipal council, including myself. I showed them the bar graph of the results, and they voted unanimously to send a message to the Ministry of Health that they should please get to work on carrying out what the expert panel suggested, their expert panel, the Ministry of Health had recruited to do these further studies. And that was the first time they reached out to the Ministry of Health was on May 29th of 2023, and there hasn't been a peep from the Ministry of Health. So, you know, it's been a couple of years now since the more than 2 years since the expert panel submitted our final report, and it's been close to a year since we provided the Ministry of Health with these heavy metal analyses from the sediment, and still nothing from the Ministry of Health.
Jeez. We have to go for a quick break now. My guest today is being Dr. Keith Benn. He's an expert geologist who's been looking into the drinking water problems in wells in the Chatham-Kent area. So we'll be right back after the break.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Be a part of a revolutionary new healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interests of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to americaoutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years, but our diet and the way we eat has, creating an environment in your mouth for bacteria to wreak havoc on your teeth and gums. For better oral health, get Spry Dental Defense, an oral care line designed to combat acid-creating bacteria. The toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and gum all contain xylitol, a natural ingredient shown to dramatically improve oral health. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural retailers.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to americaoutloud.shop. That's americaoutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Lifestyle changes are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created heart and vascular health to support cholesterol and blood pressure with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow. Get heart healthy. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud for 25% off.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
So I'm back with Dr. Keith Benn, a professional geoscientist who's actually studied the drinking water problems that have been experienced by Christine Burke in the Chatham-Kent area. Now, I have here actually a sample of her water, which I'll put up on under the podcast when it goes up on Monday. And it sure doesn't take much movement before it's all black. You know, it's set. So I understand from Christine that because of the vibration, it doesn't settle out. It stays pretty well suspended and it comes out of her tap like that. Are you surprised by that, or is that something you'd expect with this circumstance?
I'm not surprised by it. I wouldn't say I expect it, because when you're studying a complex earth system like this, when you focus on what you're expecting, you end up being wrong most of the time. But I'm not surprised by it in the least. I mean, these are really, really, really fine-grained particles for the most part. And, 50 microns or less, and some of them as small as 1 micron or less. And for your audience, just for the non-specialists, 1 micron is 1/1000th of a millimeter.
Whoa.
And
okay.
For those in the States, that's pretty small. You'll have to do your conversion yourself.
My millionth of
days are way behind me now, but.
A millionth of an inch or something.
Because they're so small, and because a lot of those minerals are probably chlorite and micaceous minerals and other clays, they're not very dense. So as long as that water is flowing, up the well and intake pipe and through the domestic water supply, it's perfectly normal that that stuff be in suspension. It gets carried along very easily. It's just like a larger scale sedimentary system in nature. If a river is carrying sediment from up in the mountains, as it's rushing down the mountain, it carries boulders and big cobbles and pebbles and stuff like that. And as the current slows down, those bigger, heavier particles fall out, but the really fine particles stay in suspension in the water, and they go farther downstream and form clay on the bottom of the river someplace or a beach somewhere eventually. So that's not all that surprising. And it's the fine-grained nature of the sediment is also one of the things that's pretty worrisome. I mean, as I mentioned previously, earlier in this discussion, the dark-colored material in suspension in the water is probably derived, for the most part, from this black shale that underlies the aquifer. It would have been torn up and ground up by the glaciers, but it's probably comes mostly from that black shale. That black shale is the top of the bedrock under much of this area here in southwestern Ontario. It's about 360 million year old black shale. And it's known to be a black shale of a type that is called metals rich black shale, or other people use the term metalliferous black shale. This is known. It's been published. There have been one or two master's theses done on it, and then those data were republished by the Geological Survey of Canada and compared to other metal-rich black shales elsewhere in Canada. We're not just claiming it's metals-rich. This has been known for decades. And it's also, there's a fair amount of methane gas in it, but that's a whole other story. So this metals-rich black shale, when the metals are associated with such tiny, fine particles, I find that particularly worrisome, because it stands to reason that the finer the particle, the greater the chance that the metal within the particle or on the surface of the particle is going to be released more easily within someone's digestive tract, for instance. If you were unfortunate enough to swallow a 1 centimeter cube size piece of sediment, the metal in the middle of it is unlikely to be released in your gastric tract. But if it's a 1 micron size particle, interactions with your gastric juices, with the chyme and your stomach, I think there's a good chance that it could release some of these metals. I've done a bit of reading on other types of sediments that have been analyzed for this kind of problem, similar, not the same, exactly the same. And, they found that a certain percentage of the metals does get released into people's digestive systems.
And this is arsenic and lead and cadmium. And these are not things you want in your digestive system.
No. And you don't want them in your organs.
Mm-hmm.
If that stuff makes its way through the tissue lining the walls of your intestines, for instance, or it gets into your bloodstream and gets carried to your liver or some other organ in your body, it's probably not going to be a good thing, especially if it's accumulating there over a number of years. And because these type, my understanding is, and I've looked into this a bit in the past for health reasons, once these heavy metals get into your organs, they don't get flushed out very easily. They accumulate, and you just get more and more and more. And no, it's not a good thing at all. So this is why the expert panel, on the expert panel, I was the only geologist. There were four other people who were toxicologists. So they have a deeper understanding of what happens when you get these sorts of toxins into, or potential toxins into your system. And, you know, that's why we recommended that bioaccessibility studies should be done if the sediments were to be analyzed, which we did, and we were to find heavy metals in them, which we did, then bioaccessibility studies need to be done first to find out if the metals are, you know, some percentage of those metals is going to be released into people's bodies if they cook pasta in this stuff, or if they drink it, or if they make coffee with it. You know, so some people in their wells too, you know, they don't have this black water coming out, but they still have a bit of turbidity, and you can see it in the water, and it's the same material, just maybe not quite so much of it. But you know, you throw that in your coffee pot and you make coffee with it, and you're going to get some of that.
Yeah. And Christine says that while she doesn't drink it, although it was interesting, she was advised by some government officials that it was fine to drink, you know. Well, but obviously it isn't.
Well, it's until the bioaccessibility studies are done, the extent of the health hazard remains unknown. In my opinion, there is definitely, undoubtedly, there is a potential health hazard here. And that potential health hazard, it screams out for studies to find out the degree, or the level of the health hazard, if you will. And then, you know, the question would be mitigation. You know, what do you do about this? Well, but the only thing I can imagine right now is, well, maybe if they were to tear out the wind turbines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But probably the best solution right now would be that somebody would have to provide all these people with municipal water. But that's what I'm thinking, but there could be other solutions as well. You have to understand too, that many of these households, I think probably the majority, are farm families. And they were using this water for, you know, irrigation and for cattle and stuff, you know, watering cattle and all that. And so, you know, if they were to be put on municipal water, then they'd have to be paying for the water that they were getting free from their well before.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, I mean, that just stands to reason. So it's a complicated matter. But I think right now it is urgent that the government of Ontario, who are the culprits who forced these industrial wind turbines on the people to begin with, need to follow up on this and find out, or determine, the extent of the health hazard that's associated with this sediment. And that's even separate from proving that the wind turbines actually caused this. But
yeah. If I were guessing, I would think that if you're elected MPP, member of provincial parliament, that you'd push for this in the House of Representation.
Yes, at the Legislative Assembly of Ontario, I would definitely push for this. And I wouldn't only push within the assembly, but also I would be knocking on the door of the Ministry of Health and saying, I want to speak to some people here. You know, I am the newly elected representative of the people in this area, and you know, people who live within the municipality of Chatham-Kent that reached out to you a year ago and pointed out that we have heavy metals now in coming out of people's water wells, or contained in the sediment coming out with the water, and that your own expert panel, of which I was a member, indicated that these bioaccessibility and bioavailability studies need to be carried out. When can we expect it to happen? Please.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I wouldn't stop knocking on the door until I got an answer.
Now, just taking a broader picture, what do you think this is similar to what may be happening in other areas too, or is it actually unique to the Chatham-Kent area?
Well, those are two separate questions, really. You know, Is exactly what's happening in the Chatham-Kent area unique to the Chatham-Kent area? Well, it would be unique to places that had an aquifer like the one in Chatham-Kent and with a composition like the one in Chatham-Kent. But other similar problems arising from industrial wind turbines affecting groundwater, which would be similar to the case in Chatham-Kent, could be occurring elsewhere. And I checked out your website, and I looked at some of the information on the gentleman from, was it Pennsylvania, I believe?
Central Illinois.
Illinois, excuse me. Yeah, from Illinois. Yeah. And I'm thinking, yes, that looks to me like it could very well be something that was caused by industrial wind turbine vibrations. Yeah. Now, you see, in that case, maybe they don't have heavy metal laden sediments there. I don't know. Maybe they do. But maybe there's some other toxin that's getting into the water. And in any case, there's also just the question of the quality of the water and the drinkability of the water. I mean, when you have turbid stuff coming out of your water taps, whether it's white or black or brown or green or red, that doesn't necessarily give you motivate you to pour a great big glass of that and maybe add a shot of gin or something and sit around and on your porch and drink it in the summertime. Or to fill your child's water bottle up with it and send them off to a baseball game or something, it is worrisome. And I think that there is a distinct possibility that in that case, and probably some others, there could be this kind of problem. I know that there are some industrial wind turbine complexes being proposed up around your area, around Ottawa.
Yeah, for sure.
And there is a black shale unit up there as well. So this could prove to be a problem.
So we got to tell these people about that and the fact that they need to have studies done before they even consider constructing
them. Well, I've said to several people in the past, that the biggest error of all in this whole sad story was made whenever the day was that somebody asked somebody for their advice on whether we should put these industrial wind turbines here. And I have to imagine that somebody in government was consulted at some point, Ministry of the Environment or probably Ministry of the Environment. You know, like knowing what you know about this area geologically, is this a good place to put these wind turbines? And if I was the one who was being consulted and if I knew about the aquifer, as I now do, I would have said, no, go somewhere else. This is the worst possible place where you could build this because it's almost impossible there. I got it out that you wouldn't interfere with this aquifer.
Yeah.
Given that
it's shallow,
it's a perfectly serviceable aquifer, but it's relatively thin. And we knew that there was some black shale in it too, that you probably didn't want to go messing around with. And so please just find someplace else to do this or don't do it at all. But that never happened.
Yeah. Well, one of the major drivers of the wind turbines is the idea that we're causing dangerous climate change and we need the wind turbines to give us so-called clean electricity, which, as you and Christine explained, is hardly clean. But so one thing I noticed when I look at all the different groups that are against wind turbines for all sorts of reasons, it can be for infrasound, for example, it can be for, reduction in property value. It can be all sorts of things, killing birds and bats. But the thing I noticed is that none of them are actually going to the root of the problem, namely, they're doing this because of the belief that we can supposedly stop climate change. Do you think from a strategic point of view, they should be going after the original underlying driver of wind turbines, namely the climate scare? Or is that too dangerous for them to even touch?
Well, it's becoming less dangerous to touch. I can understand, I think, I don't ever try to read other people's minds or to claim that I can read other people's minds, but I can speculate, and it's reasonable to assume that one of the reasons they haven't taken that approach in defending themselves against industrial wind turbine complexes is that the climate scare frenzy, up until very recently, and even now for many people, was so intense in people's minds that as soon as someone spoke up and said, you don't even need to build these wind turbines because there is no climate crisis, then they would turn off a whole lot of people who could be their allies. You know? And so you just want to maybe leave that on the side for the time being. But I think people are talking about it more and more now. I'm not so sure about the people who are combating the wind turbines, but at a larger scale, when you take into account industrial wind turbines and solar complexes and where we're going to source the metals and having our government start to talk about how we're not going to be able to buy gas, you know, natural gas stoves anymore, and they're putting taxes on carbon, as they call it. I'm making a quotation mark sign here with my fingers. And it's not carbon at all that they're supposedly taxing. It's called carbon dioxide, guys. Please learn just a little bit of chemistry. I think more people now are starting to snap out of it and realize that the whole thing is a scam. I think the climate alarmists have overreached. And it's gotten to the point now where a lot of people who are kind of complacent and saying, okay, well, a climate crisis, okay, it's there, so we'll build some wind turbines and not worry about it. Now that this whole thing is closing in on us so much with taxes and this and this, and you know, people are waking up and going, wait a minute, slow down here. We're not convinced that there is a climate crisis. I mean, I have in my presentation that I'll be giving this evening to a group of people in Forest in the northern part of my riding. You know, I have a clip from that shows Dr. John Clauser, who was a joint winner of the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2022, mm-hmm. who comes out and says there is no climate crisis. And there are thousands of other scientists who are saying the same thing, thousands of them, who are now coming kind of out of the closet now, too, if I can put it that way, and finding the courage to come out and say this. I used to work in a academic environment, so I have some feeling for how university academics who depend on government funding to a large degree to fund their research, maybe a little bit hesitant to go against the government narrative, but they're finding their courage now, and some are, and even oh gosh, now I'm sorry, his name escapes me. It shouldn't. Dr. Patrick Moore, you know, the famous right? Patrick Moore. Nobody can accuse Patrick Moore of not being an environmentalist, I don't think, being a co-founder of Greenpeace.
Yeah.
And even he comes out, he doesn't say necessarily that there's no climate crisis, but he says, look, Earth's climate changes all the time, and this is not being driven by human activity, which is absolutely valid. So I think, and these people are gaining traction now, you know, we're not getting so much of the, there are a few lunatics still out there, like the Minister of the Environment or whatever his name, or whatever his title is.
In Ottawa, yeah.
Yeah, Guibo. The guy with his orange jumpsuit from when he was arrested at some demonstration or another. They're still trying to push this on us, but, you know, another thing that bothers me about this whole climate thing, too, is I work internationally a lot, and I've worked in a number of developing countries, as we say, and I see the effect that this has on people in those countries in different ways. One is that there tends to be a notion amongst many people in developing countries that there is a climate crisis, and it's all the fault of the developing world, so we owe them billions of dollars that we better ship over there right now to compensate them. And they believe that because they were told that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Other things I see, you know, in Tanzania, for instance, and in Malawi, where I was not too long ago, not for work, but to visit my son, there's a lot of deforestation that goes on. In Tanzania, where I worked for nearly 2 years, you know, you have all of these, you know, I have a bit of topography and the hills are all getting deforested because people cut down the trees, understandably, I'm not blaming them, to make charcoal that then they haul into the local market on their bicycles. They have bags of charcoal and they sell them in the market because people need charcoal to cook with and to heat their homes. When you live at, 900 or 1,000 meters altitude, it can get to be a bit chilly at night. Huh. And Offshore from Tanzania, there are natural gas reserves that are in the ground. And word is that, international forces put pressure on the government of Tanzania to not, develop or not allow development of these natural gas fields, which would provide natural gas that would serve the people of their country so they wouldn't have to cut down all the trees to make charcoal.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
There's so many outcomes of the climate scare that are damaging to people. We have
Yeah.
to wrap up now. My thinking is that it's sort of like Benjamin Franklin when he tried to get them to all work together to oppose the British. I mean, he said, we have to hang together or we'll all hang separately. And I think that's similar here. I mean, you have so many things that the climate scare affects, and we were listing quite a few of them. I think they have to recognize they all have a common enemy. And they're going to have to speak out against this climate scare. Otherwise, all these individual groups will hang separately, So, I mean, I think that people have got to work together to kill the climate scare. It has so many bad outcomes. We
Yeah.
have to end, unfortunately. I'd love to keep talking with you. But my guest today has been Dr. Keith Benn, and he's running to be the representative, the member of provincial parliament for in the upcoming Lambton Kent Middlesex, Ontario election. And it's really amazing. We've got to get people like Dr. Ben into the House, all right, in this case, the provincial parliament, because so many there just don't know what they're talking about. And actually, Dr. Ben obviously really does. So thanks so much for being on my show.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, that's great. So this is Tom Harris signing out from the other side of the story. If you're enjoying this episode, we ask that you donate to the International Climate Science Coalition, or ICSC, at ICSC. Climate.com to help us pay for the show. We get about 50,000 listeners per program, so it's certainly worth continuing. Please visit ICSC-climate.com and click on the red donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Once again, that's ICSC-climate.com. Help us bring our program, The Other Side of the Story, to thousands more.